But the question is being raised with regard to the idea of Goel Hadan, that's literally the redeemer of the blood, meaning a close relative of someone who's been killed. There is a phenomenon that when someone has been killed, most specifically, it has to do with the case where he's been killed b'shogeg. That is, it wasn't intentional, but it was negligent. Negligent homicide, I guess they would call it. And it has to be somewhere in the middle, in terms of the extent of the negligence. If it's very severe negligence, so then he's not sent, he's not punished by being sent to Eir Mikvah. That's where the phenomenon of the city of refuge comes in. They had six cities of refuge designated for killers who were not deemed suitable to receive execution because it was b'shogeg. On the other hand, if it's karav la'ones, if the amount of negligence is very, very slight, very minor, and it's essentially an accident. As you could see, driving, you could have an accident. There could be negligence, where a person is driving negligently. Sometimes, you know, you do that. Weaving in and out, going through red lights, etc. In driving, you could see a case where it's even worse, where it's close to mazut. It's virtually intentional, because the way the person is driving is obviously into an accident. Serious endangerment. Then you can have something which is very close to being an accident. It's, somebody just ran across the street from between two cars. There's no way you could have seen him. So you're a good driver. You were doing everything right. And there's no question. There are cases where it's completely the fault of the victim. And then you can have something in between where there was an element of negligence. However, the degree is something that most people engage in, and most of the time it doesn't lead to an accident, that type of thing. Where the shogeg is not defined as close to intentional or as close to accidental, it's basically in between. So he's liable. He's liable for that degree of negligence. He should not have engaged. He should have been careful. He should have known that in that situation there exists a good possibility that harm will come. And somebody was killed as a result of that. That's, for example, when he's going down the ladder. So that's called Derech Yirida. In that case, he is defined as a Rotzeach. But it's Rotzeach, which means murderer. That's murder. He's a murderer. However, he's a murderer b'shogeg, by accident, so to speak. I'm using the word accident, obviously, more descriptively here. What is the punishment for such a person? Of course, the first thing he should do is to go to Eir Mikvah. Whenever anybody commits a murder, even intentionally, he has to immediately go to the Eir Mikvah, because this law of the Goel Hadam, the redeemer of the blood, kicks in. And the Goel Hadam has permission to kill him. So therefore, well, that's also interesting to note. Every aspect of this has questions connected to it. And that is that he has permission, but only if he's outside of the Eir Mikvah. Once he's in the Eir Mikvah, he has a refuge. And it's prohibited. If the Goel Hadam goes in and kills him inside the Eir Mikvah, then he's a murderer. That's murder. So therefore, it was obligatory to set up three cities of refuge, equidistant. They had to keep the roads in very good condition. There had to be signs pointing Eir Mikvah, so that if a person should need it, he should have access to get there. So it's an interesting kind of thing. We're trying to save him from the Goel Hadam. It's interesting because we've created the Goel Hadam. There's certain ambivalence. Now, on the one hand, we create the institution of Goel Hadam, and we say the Goel Hadam has permission to kill him. On the other hand, that if that's the case, we have to protect him against that which we ourselves have created. So it's pretty obvious that even though you have the phenomenon of the Goel Hadam, but the preference is that he should receive a trial. So he goes to the Eir Miklat. Assuming he goes to the Eir Miklat, then the Sanhedrin, the one that has jurisdiction, in this case, will send for him and will escort him to the Sanhedrin so he can be tried. And escort him so he shouldn't be killed by the Goel Adam on the way. Then he's tried. If it's a matter of intentional, if it's a case where he killed him intentionally, he's tried for his life. His life is on the line. And if he's found guilty, so then he's going to be executed by the Bezdin. If he's found innocent, so then he's free. Nitzadik b'din, he's been vindicated in din, and he's free. And nobody can touch him. The Goel Adam can't touch him, because he's innocent, he's putter. With regard to someone who is being tried for shogeg, if he's found innocent, same thing. He's putter. Nobody can touch him. If he's found guilty, so now he's liable to the penalty, which is Eir Miklat. He has to live the rest of his life in Eir Miklat, or until the Kohen Gadol dies. It's very difficult to just approach this in isolation. One aspect, there's a lot of factors that are intertwined over here. What's this whole concept? I always like to broaden it, because you can't treat it in isolation. It fits into a bigger picture. You have to get a sense of the bigger picture. So really the question has to be, what's going on over here? It seems like a strange type of a punishment. The punishment is he has to go to Eir Miklat. That we can identify. How would you characterize the punishment? What kind of a punishment is it? So he's not in this city, he's in another city. Well, the answer is he's going into exile. He has to leave his environs and go in. It's a form of exile. There's different degrees of exile. He doesn't leave the country. That we don't do to him, because that's really destroying him. However, he has to leave his own community. That's not a simple thing when you think about it, all the elements that are involved. The person's built up a life. This is his town, his people, his community, his business, his reputation, and so on. He has to leave that behind. He goes, this is considered to be exile. The nature of the punishment is that he accepts exile upon himself. So as long as he's in that state, he's in the Eir Miklat, so he's immune. He has an immunity. He can't be touched. Can't be punished. But it's interesting to note that in, with regard to that, that terminates with the death of the Kohen Gadol. That once the Kohen Gadol dies, so then he's free. He has his kapara, his atonement, and he leaves, and now nobody can touch him. He's free. However, while he's supposed to be in the Eir Miklat, he's not allowed to leave. And if he leaves, then the Goel Adam can kill him. So, there's a lot of questions with regard to this. Why is this the appropriate punishment? And is the person liable to the death penalty or not liable? How does it work that if he is liable, so why did we send him to the city of refuge? And if he's not liable, so then why is he endangered if he leaves the Eir Miklat? It seems like that the Goel Adam has the right to kill him because he left the Eir Miklat. That's not the crime. The Goel Adam is a halachic institution, and it shouldn't be taken as it is superficially that it's basically to satisfy his emotions. That does not make sense at all on any level whatsoever. Especially the Torah's system of justice is not geared towards satisfying people's emotions. The person is insulted, he's not allowed to take revenge. But what about the emotion? Because you have an emotion doesn't make it right. Moreover, if the victim doesn't have a Goel Adam, so Bezdin appoints one. So you see, that's an institution that has to exist. A question is being raised with regard to a trial. A Reform rabbi in New Jersey has just been convicted of the conspiracy to kill his wife. That is to say that everybody admits that he didn't kill her himself, but that he hired a hitman. Because he was involved in an affair with a woman and she threatened to break it up and whatever. The whole case. And we're not saying that the conviction is actually the truth and not the truth. That's the way it came out in court. So we're not interested in that. However, What we find interesting is that the individual who admits to the killing, and there's no doubt at all, no one's maintaining that this person is not the killer, clearly the killer. And he's the one who's saying he did it because he was hired by the rabbi. So that was what the whole trial was about. And the jury found guilty, that the rabbi is guilty. The interesting thing is that in comparing American law to Torah law, that the rabbi, who didn't do the murder, but let's assume that it's true, let's assume that he hired the hitman, is considered much, much worse. He is, in fact, subject, I think it will be decided today, to the death penalty. He could get the death penalty, even though he didn't do the killing. And the actual killer is not only not getting the death penalty, but cut a deal with the state, and I think he's going to get off maybe scot-free or minimal type of thing. So it's clear, by doing that, the state made a decision that the killer, the one who did the killing, is not as dangerous, or is not as bad, or is not as wicked, whatever term you want to use, as the one who hired him to do it. Now the question is, how does the Torah look at that? Who would be prosecuted in the Torah system? Who would the Torah system look at as being the more serious offender? From a halachic perspective, there'd be no case, actually, against the rabbi if it was a Sanhedrin, if it was Jewish law. Because even if we accept the fact that he hired the hitman, and there's no doubt about that, we had witnesses that he did that, that's not a crime. That's punishable by the court. Because in the Torah system, there is no concept that somebody else made me do it. There is no concept, there is a concept of nesis. We learned about nesis. Yeah, in that sense, that would be the chet. The crime would be to seduce somebody else into an aver. But when a person does that, there's a difference between seducing somebody else into an aver and the concept that it's not his sin, it's not his crime, it becomes transferred to you since you're the one that ordered the hit, so to speak. The idea that somebody else's action becomes attributable to you, that's the way it should be analyzed. Now there's a very important principle over here. What's the principle? It's called any shlichus v'dvar avera. That there's no shlichus. There is an institution of shlichus, agency, which works in halacha. If you designate a person to do an action for you, in terms of kedushin, for example, that a person can marry a woman directly, of course, or through a shliach. You appoint a shliach with the power to perform the kedushin, and the action, the effects of the action, of course, reverts back to you. When your shliach does it, so then he gives her the ring, he says, and you become married to her. So there is a phenomenon of shlichus. However, when it comes to an avera, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't become your avera. Why? Because any shliach is our avera. What does that mean? That is to say that the action cannot be attributable to somebody else. You can't say you were acting on his behalf. You can only say that when the action is permitted. But where the action is prohibited, so you know how to do it. So therefore, in order for you to do it, you had to make a decision to violate the command prohibiting you from doing it. So therefore, you did it. It's your action. It's your decision. Now, the reason why you did it may be because of the reward that you're going to get from that other person, but that's no different than any other motive you have. You rob a bank because of the money. So in halacha, it becomes your domain, it becomes your action, and the other person is guilty for a different crime, for seduction. But just because he's guilty for seduction doesn't mean that the avera, or the action, becomes transferred back to him. So this is a tremendous gulf between the two systems. Whereas in American law, it becomes your murder. Conspiracy to murder renders you a murderer, and as we see that he's going to be treated more harshly than the actual murderer. Now the question is being raised as to what determines where it even does work. Because we in the realm of mitzvahs, for example, in terms of marrying a woman, you can do it through a shliach. You don't have to be present at your own wedding. But neither does the bride have to be present. They don't. Because she can have a shliach, and then he can have a shliach, and they can be there at the... If you just don't like boring wedding parties, you don't have to be present. You can be wherever it is you want to be for your honeymoon. You can all be there already and just wait for the phone call. The wedding just took place. Now, then you're man and wife at that point. Why waste your time at a a social function that you don't enjoy.
Yeah.
See, along those lines, you have to realize it's extremely expensive. It's extremely expensive. So what you do is you get like 10 or 20 different couples, and you all chip in to hire the hall and all the things, the music, the whole thing. And then you just do the 20 that night. You can have a shliach. You see, for the same shliach can function as soon as you finish one, then you do another one for another party, and so forth. So another question is being raised on a serious note, that take the case of Kedushin, but isn't that a mitzvah? And the whole idea that a mitzvah is supposed to perfect the person by giving it over to somebody else and having somebody else do it, doesn't that diminish from your involvement in mitzvahs? It's true, the Gemara itself takes that up in Kedushin, and it says mitzvah bo yosef v'shulcho. That's a greater mitzvah. Therefore, what it's really telling you is that you fulfill the mitzvah by yourself or through your shliach, but it's a bigger mitzvah if you do it yourself. That would answer your question. Then you're correct. In terms of the performance of the mitzvah, if you're giving it over to somebody else to perform, you're going to lose that benefit and perfection of performing a mitzvah. But the truth is, however, and if it doesn't work, for whatever reason, let's say you can't. There are cases where you're married by proxy. This tactic was used in cases, I think, like the Jewish population in Syria, you know, they're under a tremendous oppression, to bypass the laws that they wouldn't let the Jews out of the country and all that. So I think one of the methods that were used were proxy marriages in Kedushin. So the woman could appoint a shliach, so somebody in America could marry that person just for the sake of pidyon shvuyim. And then, because the marriage is recognized in America, she becomes an American citizen. And then, you know, the Americans can press for her right to leave the country. Those types of tactics have been used. So I'm just using that as an example to show you that it's a good thing to have. There are cases where it's being done for a good purpose. What determines where it's applicable, where it can be utilized? For example, you can't make somebody or shliach to daven for you, what to learn for you, what to blow the shofar for you, things like that. I would say that in certain types of mitzvahs, the idea is an absurdity. I'll give a very simplistic example. It would be akin to appointing somebody to eat for you, or to do exercise for you. To appoint someone to learn for you is like saying to appoint someone, you do exercise for me. So it's laughable. Nobody would take that seriously. Because the whole essence of the activity is something which pertains to you. It's your action. And whatever benefit it contains can only come about through your being involved in it. The same is true with the mitzvahs in general. The benefit of davening, the benefit is to be involved in the tefillah, the activity of tefillah, to focus your thoughts and all of that. So that's you. Or you can't have somebody do something for you. It's an impossibility. Or to put on tefillin for you. What benefit? There's no benefit. The whole benefit is to be involved in a certain type of an activity, which produces a certain result. And by definition, it has to be you, the person that's involved in it. The person is going to maintain that the essence, the whole benefit of the mitzvah is to understand and become familiar with its concepts and ideas. Therefore, for some reason, you could have somebody else do it. That's not going to work, because you can't say that. Whatever you're going to say, no one's going to argue that if I just study every aspect of tefillin and learn everything there is to know about tefillin, but I don't do the mitzvah, that is sufficient. There is a necessity to actually put them on. What brings about a certain realization, it becomes more of a reality for you, it becomes a part of you. It affects you not just in an intellectual way, it affects you in an emotional way. So there's a perfection in the performance of the mitzvah. To that extent, it can only be if you perform the mitzvah. Thus, the question is, why is Kedushin different? The reason is as follows. There's two different elements in Kedushin and marriage. It's kind of like two tracks. On one track, it partakes of an acquisition, kinyan. It's like a business type of phenomenon, in which case the shlichus exists. Because the essence of shlichus is that you can empower other people It's a very important concept in the business world, so to speak. You can transfer. In conducting a business deal, it's essentially your acquisition. So it's based upon your agreement, your will to do something. So you can grant that power to others. In English, it's called power of attorney. So therefore, you may not be doing the physical act of acquisition, but you've empowered this person to go out and conduct a deal for you. That makes perfect sense. He's representing you. You need representation. And he's empowered by you to conduct the legal actions which are essential. That's why the concept exists. Therefore, it will exist even in Kedushin, because the way it's structured, it partakes of the element of an acquisition, and you almost like a purchase. You give money, and she accepts the money, and in return, she gives herself over to you, so to speak, for the purpose of marriage. So, insofar as that's the nature of the phenomenon, it partakes of that, so you can appoint a shliach. It doesn't have to be you personally who does the act of acquisition. The only thing is that the sense here, it's not just a secular phenomenon, it does partake of mitzvah and all of that. Then we're saying that since it's amazing that's a mitzvah, the more you're involved in mitzvah, that itself has a perfection, so it's better to do it yourself. But since it's also a reality, a legal reality, that when you appoint someone, you give the person power of attorney, you designate him, the actions that he performs under that power redound to you, so that will have that effect. You can marry through a shliach. But that is the only type of case in which a mitzvah can be achieved through someone else, where it has to do with that element of transferring your will, that he expresses your will and your power to conduct business or acquisitions. Anything else, where the essence of the mitzvah has to do with the action per se, that you can't transfer. You can't say that what somebody else is doing is your action. That you cannot say. So you can't say it for mitzvah. You can't say it for mitzvah. You can't say it. You can't say it for avera, as we've shown. There's no shlichus for avera. When the person commits an avera, it is his own action. It does not get transferred over to you.